Oh no, in most cases that is a sin against one's body. You may suffer for it in this life or in some future incarnation, by treating others badly, then? No, as a rule even this is no sin against your soul. You will get your punishment for treating others badly in this or some future incarnation, although wanton cruelty to defenseless creatures, rat-like ingratitude, or an innate tendency to spy on others already reveal a certain degree of soullessness which may be due to sins committed against one's soul in former incarnations. Well, then, what is a sin against one's soul? Using spiritual things for selfish purposes. Dragging God down on earth. Trying to put one's self on a level with the Creator. Dalma was awe-stricken. Then many of us hear sin like that, she exclaimed. Yes, Dalma, but also people in other countries. In India. Certainly. In P/Inpa? She looked at me in a very queer way when she said that. Of course, there some people sin against their soul too. P/Inpa must resemble Tibet in certain respects, I added after a while. I will tell you something interesting, said Dalma. Narabu, my teacher, has told me that P/Inpa is not at all one country. It is a country divided into many small provinces which often take a stand one against another. Really? In some ways you are very similar to Narabu, Chedi, but in others, especially in spiritual matters, you do not say exactly the same things. I think he would very much like to meet you to discuss such matters. The country of the white people. Telin really means a being from a distant island. Island is translated Lingerng Bring in Tibetan. Where is he at present? I asked. He travels very much. He may be at home at present. A few weeks ago he returned to his Dzong from Lhasa. He will go soon to the Valley of Mystery. The Valley of Mystery? If you do not know what the Valley of Mystery is, I am not allowed to tell you more about it. So please do not mention it anymore, she said, with a firmness which was almost startling in so young a girl. She noticed my disappointment, smiled, and said sweetly, but I will give you an introduction to Narabu, but please promise me one thing. What is it? When you meet Narabu, do not tell him that I mentioned to you the Valley of Mystery. I thought you knew all about it when I said that word, because you seem to know so much about spiritual matters. I am bound by a solemn oath not to speak of the valley. If Narabu wants to tell you something about it he may do so, as he occupies a much higher rank in the occult fraternity. More and more I was dumbfounded. There is no such thing as coincidence in this world. We make chance acquaintances, but everything in our lives seems to be guided by an intricate mechanism, the working of which we fail to see. We had arrived at the central court of the monastery where the theatrical performance was to take place. It was to last many hours and the public came along, carrying a fairly large quantity of food and drink. We went on chatting and the time passed very rapidly. The Tibetans are people who take their time. 3/4 of an hour before the time fixed for the show, the courtyard and the galleries were already packed with people, although the crowds were perhaps a little smaller than the previous day, when the Sangmai had appeared to make a demonstration of his capacity to enter publicly in contact with his gods or demons. I glanced at Dalma again and again. Was it possible that this little girl was the friend and spiritual disciple of a rich and powerful Tibetan who occupied a prominent position in the country, and was a member of a powerful secret body? Of course, there was something about Dalma which distinguished her enormously from any other Tibetan girl of her age. I looked at her dress. It was very simple and yet almost elegant. She did not make the smallest display of ornaments, which is a very uncommon thing amongst Tibetan women. She was clean, which is another remarkable feature in Tibet. She was educated and knew a lot, not only about Tibet but also about India. I once more looked at her fully, comparing her with the crowd around us. It was like looking at a duchess who had borrowed the clothes of one of her servants and was mixing with a crowd in the East End. The merry chatter of the people died away. The performance had begun. It was very difficult for me to understand all that was said by the actors. First of all, the classical language used differed to some extent from colloquial Tibetan, the difference being about as great as the one between modern English used in business correspondence and the English in the Shakespeare folio. Furthermore, many of the actors wore masks, which rendered understanding still more difficult. On the other hand, however, the plot of the play was very slight. Developments which would take perhaps 3 minutes on an English stage would run out into scenes lasting sometimes 40 minutes. Moreover, the dialogue was supported by enormous gestures enabling even people seated at a considerable distance to guess developments. Taking all in all, I could understand a great deal. The play glorified renunciation and non-resistance to evil. Again and again it stressed the prospect of getting happiness as a reward for renunciation. The hero of the play, I use the word in a technical sense, for a pitiful hero he was for that matter, was out to discard his personality in order to get happiness. Why do people seek an unselfish conception of life? Is it because we have so much love and sympathy with the troubles of others that we begin to be ashamed of our selfishness which causes so much suffering? Or is it because we want happiness in exchange for a non-egocentrical conception of life? In the play performed in the monastery, the motive of the hero was the latter and not the former. He wanted bliss as a reward for discarding his personality. The play started with an exceedingly long monologue on the evils of existence. I quote from memory. The taking down of notes while I traveled in disguise in Tibet was most difficult and only possible on rare occasions. The hero in the play dwelt at great length on the various evils of existence. He seemed to lose sight of the many things which make life worth living and which are partly even within the reach of a people not specially favored by fortune, such as love, friendship, enthusiasm, beauty of nature, etc. Life is bad, he mused. Life is suffering and penury. Nothing is real. Everything is unreal. Annihilation is the goal. I looked at beautiful Dolma. I looked at the sun generously filling with his radiant light the courtyard of the monastery, and wondered whether the poor hero realized what dreadful blasphemy he was uttering. What? The Creator should have made this wonderful universe, full of suffering, true, but also full of enjoyment, the suffering preventing enjoyment from becoming monotonous, for the purpose that his creatures should realize that existence was an evil and that their supreme goal was to escape from it. I compared the poor hero in the Tibetan play with the glorious figure of Hamlet, who intensely feels the dreadful tragedy of being only a man and nothing but man. Being a genius and capable of the most intense feelings, Hamlet suffers infinitely more than the Tibetan hero, but nevertheless he has the courage and nobility of character to face his troubles as a creature without any thought of escape or salvation. The hero was married and had children. He worked to feed his family. He was attacked by a swarm of mosquitoes. The lamas had a strange stage trick to represent an enormous swarm of mosquitoes. I wondered how it was done, but it looked very genuine. The hero gave his lifeblood to the mosquitoes. "The dear little ones," he said, "let them have a good meal. I have to feed my family, but the family and the mosquitoes are the same thing." Having fed so many mosquitoes, the hero was taken ill and the play went on, describing his sufferings and the sufferings of his family brought about by his inability to work. Just when their food supply was running out, rats put in an appearance in their house. The part of rats was played by Tibetan children who wore masks and neatly carried their long tails under their arms. The hero said, "Eat, little rats, eat, 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 feed your little bodies, gray brothers. Eat, gray brothers, eat, eat, eat. Our food is yours, gray brothers. Eat, little rats, eat, eat, eat." I quote these passages from memory, but should like to add that the text of the dialogues and monologues was much longer, and much more elaborate. The rats ate the food of the semi-starved family and became more and more numerous. A scene came in now in which the hero exalted the happiness of giving away everything. "If the rats eat the first half of my meal, I give them the second half," he exclaimed, in what a heretical spectator might have called a fit of religious hysteria. He did not seem to consider what his own children thought of it, but this seemed to be of less importance to him than the well-being of the rats. All the above had lasted more than 2 hours, but the play went on uninterruptedly, the Tibetan crowds following it with breathless suspense. Some people had their mouths wide open, while others shed tears, and not a whisper could be heard. In the following scene, the rats had become fourfold in number. All the food was eaten. The hero and his children were seated in the center, and a few dozen rats walked round them in circles which were becoming smaller and smaller. "Kaya, Kaya. We are hungry. Round, round, round. There is nothing to eat. Kaya, Kaya, Kaya," came the chorus of the rats. The hero started a long monologue full of pity for the rats. The religious gentleman seemed to have forgotten all about the hunger of his own children. Suddenly the rats seized one of the children and carried the little one outside in order to devour it. The hero was unperturbed. He started a lofty monologue about the joy of sacrificing one's own children and the glory of union of all creatures. At that moment a Tibetan youngster stifled a laugh. The public was aghast and there were loud shouts of protest. The sinner was instantly escorted round, round, out by a few lamas and the play went on. It was some time before a few old ladies had got over their indignation. Dalma told me in whispers that she could not remember having seen a play where the religious tendency had been so apparent as in the present one. The amusement of the Tibetan youngster had greatly upset the lamas. Dalma said that it was probable they would quickly cancel a few of the remaining scenes which were most religious, as the play seemed to be too strong for the younger generation. "Have you ever seen so highly religious a play?" she asked in a low voice. "No," I said. I am sure I told the truth when I said that the monologue of the hero, which had been interrupted by the outbreak of the youngster, continued interminably. He envied his child, he declared, because it had for a short while at least made its escape from this world of suffering. He seemed to imply that death was a very cheerful and enviable process. After finishing his monologue, the hero was distinctly pleased. So were the rats. And the religious play went on. As I learned later, it was somewhat in the nature of an experiment, and the lamas had actually got together to cancel a few scenes to prevent a recurrence of the irreverent incident and the dreadful calamity of another stifled laugh. I knew that the lamas seldom failed to introduce themselves and a certain number of demons into religious plays performed in Tibetan monasteries. I was waiting anxiously for their appearance, as the endless monologues and dialogues had become rather tedious. Finally, a lama appeared in the show. He had obviously been chosen and dressed in a way calculated to show the Tibetan priesthood in the best possible light. Moreover, everything the lama said in the play seemed to be intended to strengthen the authority of the priests. The lama did not give many explanations to the devout and respectful hero, but insisted on blind belief. The latter repeated on several occasions, "I believe you, O lama. Yes, I believe you. Yes, 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 I believe you. I do not disbelieve you, O Lama. No, I do not disbelieve you. No, 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 I do not disbelieve you. The hero explained to the Lama that he had sacrificed everything in order to attain the joys of Nirvana. He enumerated his merits in a fashion none too modest. He had even given his own children to feed those poor darling rats. But he was worried about the sins he had committed before embarking in his virtuous existence. That was why he requested the spiritual assistance and advice of the Holy Lama, who deigned to meet him in a lofty spirit of sacrifice and pity for this sinful world which was so greatly in need of lamas to fight evil and to take a stand for encouragement to be good. Admonition to avoid evil. Advice to clean the heart. Such as is the law of the Buddhist. If my memory serves me correctly, the last two verses were even textually borrowed from Sanskrit and pronounced by the actor in that language with a strong Tibetan accent, Sachitaparya Dapanam, Etam Buddhsnasasanam. The following is a synopsis of the subsequent conversation between the sinner and the Lama, freely translated from the lofty and complicated language used by the Tibetan actors into simple and intelligible English. Sinner, I am glad you are here to advise me. Lama, what can I do for you? Sinner, I have sinned very badly in earlier life. Lama, it does not matter. I am glad you sinned then. Sinner, what? You, a holy man, are glad that I sinned? Lama, yes, I am glad you sinned, because there is more joy for 3 sinners who repent than for 300 people who need not repent because they have never sinned. I could not help thinking that under such conditions it is really a fine thing to sin, because there is more joy about sinners who repent than about the permanently virtuous. Finally, demons began to put in an appearance in the show. It seemed to be interminable. By now we had been seated at least 4 hours and the performance still went on. O Lama, give me religion. Give me religion, O Lama, exclaimed the sinner pathetically again and again. In the following scene a few demons appeared in the background. This did not seem to hasten developments in any way. The plot of the play seemed exceedingly slight. I looked at Dolma. She appeared rather bored and did not attempt to hide the fact. Shall we go? I whispered. It is a little kawa to get away without attracting attention, she answered. And then, my mother and the other members of my party are scattered all over the audience. We need not walk out together, I suggested. Well, said the girl, I shall walk out first and wait for you just beyond the western gate of the monastery. I am going at once, so at the western gate of the monastery. She repeated it with great care and left immediately, stooping a little and taking a zigzag course across the crowd. A few minutes later I followed her. There is no country in the world where people are more interested in religious matters than they are in Tibet. Religion plays a very important part in everyday conversation. Although few people are interested in really deep religious problems, talks of sorcery, divination, and alleged miracles being much difficult, more frequent than theological discussions. How dash ever, Dolma seemed to have a bent for the latter. She asked me whether I considered the attitude of the hero in the play a proper one for a really religious person. No, I answered. Shall man be selfish, then? She asked. Is it wrong to try to be good? No, but it is wrong to try to be like God. But God is good. Trying to be like God leads to goodness. The creature must not overstep its limits, I said, by trying to be like God. If he does so, he acts like the angels who revolted against the Creator. There are 2 different types of impersonality, namely, being and beingness. The former is an attribute of the creature, the latter an attribute of the Creator. Beingness is absolute impersonality where all division between the I and the non-I ceases. It is beyond the reach of the creature. What happens to a man who wants to attain this state? Asked Dalma. He commits the greatest and most deadly sin against the Creator. She looked greatly perturbed and changed the topic. Are you leaving today, Chedi? She asked. Yes, Dalma, I answered. Are you? We shall ride back in the direction of Tarakshan. What a pity that you cannot come along. Said in Sanskrit. This subtle difference cannot be expressed in any Western language. But Tarakshan is almost the same direction which I intended to take, Dalma. She did not make any attempt to hide her joy. Splendid, she exclaimed. You may follow us on horseback, and we can meet every day in the evening when the members of my party have retired. But we have good horses and ride about 30 miles a day. That is a very good plan, I said. What does your horse look like? She gave an accurate description of it. Then she asked, and yours? You never mentioned it. I do not need a horse, Dalma, I said. She thought I had made a joke. I am quite serious, I added. I can walk at least 30 miles a day. So can I, she said, but only a day or two. You can't walk 120 miles in 4 days. I can, I said, and she believed me. I then briefly explained that I did without a horse to keep in form in order to be able to traverse territories where horses cannot be used. It was arranged that I should leave the district before Dalma. She and her party would leave 2 hours later and overtake me about noon the following day. I already mentioned earlier in the book that vision in most parts of Tibet is excellent. We also devised a very simple and efficient method of marking the places we were passing. I should in most parts of Tibet this is an exceptionally good daily average to cover on horseback. There are practically no roads and the ground is often sandy. Have no difficulty in finding the place where they would put up their tents. An hour or two after nightfall I was to howl twice like a wolf. Dalma would then leave her tent and join me for some time. Are you certain that they will let you get away alone so late? I asked. Yes, she answered. I am very resourceful. By the way, I inhabit one half of the tent of my mother separated by a partition from the other half. No one is permitted to enter my room under any circumstances unless I call. Even my mother does not do it. So I shall crawl out and try to get past the man keeping watch. Should he see me, I shall tip him to keep his mouth shut. She also promised to write out a letter of introduction addressed to Narbu and to hand it to me in the evening together with an exact description of the place where his dzong was located. And now I must meet my party again, she said, when we returned to the gate of the monastery. The show is nearly over. I walked about alone in order to think. How crowded those 2 days had been. The demons taking possession of the body of the Sungmai, my meeting a beautiful and clever Tibetan girl who was about to introduce me to a powerful man belonging to an influential secret society, a genuine theatrical performance in a Tibetan monastery in all probability never before visited by any white person, all this I had observed and experienced within a period of less than 2 days. I then collected my food supply and started in the direction indicated by beautiful little Dalma. Chapter Next, Charming Members of an Occult Fraternity. Dalma and her party on horseback overtook merely in the afternoon. By the little signs imperceptibly dropped by Dalma every few hundred yards at regular intervals I could easily find the place where the party had put up their tents. I waited until about 2 hours after nightfall and then howled twice like a wolf. Dalma heard the signal and a quarter of an hour later she had joined me in the darkness. Has someone seen you leave? I asked. Yes, she answered. I could not get away without being noticed by the night watchman who has to be on the lookout for brigands. But I promised him a bag of barley meal if he will keep his mouth shut. As soon as I had done this I ran away as fast as Pal Dorji to come here, she added. Who is Pal Dorji? I asked. What, she exclaimed, you do not know who Pal Dorji was? No, I said. Dolma looked at me in a strange way. As I learnt later, there is hardly a Tibetan, including the less educated ones, who has never heard the story of Pal Dorji, a Tibetan who committed a pious murder at the epoch corresponding to our Middle Ages. Pal Dorji was a clever and resourceful fellow. When he was wanted and his pursuers hounded him to a Tibetan village, he quickly stole a horse, blackened it with soot, and galloped away, his pursuers following him and other horses. When he arrived at a river Pal Dorji swam across, but while his horse crossed the river the soot was washed away and the animal had turned white by the time they arrived on the opposite bank. When the pursuers arrived at the river they saw a man gallop away on the other side on a white horse. So these medieval cops thought that Pal Dorji had disappeared, and returned home. Dolma had brought a lot of food from her tent. Surely women are alike everywhere. They never lose sight of the physical well-being of someone in whom they are interested. She opened her food parcel, and when I refused to take meat our conversation at once turned to vegetarianism. Why do you dislike meat? She asked. I do not dislike it, I answered. Then why don't you eat it? Because I find it coarse to eat meat. If I eat a piece of meat I feel like someone who would bite into his left arm to eat it. There are some people who never eat meat, said Dolma, but I do not like them. They seem to be afraid of eating meat. Here again, you see, Dolma, that it is really meat more important why we do things than what we are doing. We chatted for half an hour and then Dolma returned to. I spent the night in my tent and started half an hour before sunrise. The party again overtook me later on in the day at a distance of about half a mile. I slightly modified my direction and followed the little signs dropped regularly by the Tibetan girl. We met again long after sunset in the same manner as the day before. Dolma told me that the watchdog had come to collect his tip in the morning and when he had got it he had gone to her mother, telling her all he knew about her absence the preceding night, thus securing a second tip. Her mother had been angry and she had told a lie about a solitary walk she had taken during the night. However, this evening she had escaped entirely unnoticed by another Tibetan who had kept watch during the night. Narabu, my teacher, has always told me that a spiritual person should never tell a lie, she said. I feel guilty, but fail to see how human society can be kept going without lies. There are people who say things which are untrue, I observed, but it is infinitely worse if someone misrepresents facts and creates a wrong impression without telling a real and formal lie. Such a thing is devilish and greatly offends the Creator much more in fact than an outright lie. I think you are right, observed Dolma. I know a story about an occurrence in a monastery which shows how a man can lie against the spirit without telling a real and formal lie. A Tibetan went to confess his sins to a lama whom he knew very well. Just before he entered the monastery he found a valuable object which he knew was the private property of the lama to whom he was going to confess his sins. He showed it to the priest, but the latter was absent-minded and without looking at it said, I do not want it. Then confession started. The Tibetan asked what he should do if he found a valuable object lying on the ground. You must hand it to the rightful owner slash said the lama, and if he cannot be found immediately, to the monastery. And if the rightful owner does not want it? Asked the Tibetan. Then you may keep it, said the lama. The Tibetan left the monastery and kept the valuable object, He knew he had not sinned and had not told a single lie. We both laughed heartily. Although this lie was no formal lie at all, I much prefer your innocent lying, Dolmer, I observed.